I want to bring on the Virginia Area Delegate, Terry W., who will introduce today's spiritual speaker. Terry, I yield the floor to you.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning, everyone. I love it when we get to Sunday morning because we get to hear a spiritual speaker. And today, I know I've heard Cindy speak before, so I have had a preview of what we're in for. Cindy J, she is the delegate, past delegate now from Florida North, panel 58. When I was at my first assembly, she was already a year ahead of me, so she knew what was going, and I have no idea what I'm doing. What do I do now? And so Cindy was one of the people who could, well, now you do this, and then this is going to happen. That was very helpful. Then this past year, Cindy and I both were assigned to the same task force. We worked together all last summer in through the fall, preparing the conflict resolution workshop materials that some of you heard last night. So it is my great pleasure to introduce to you this morning, Cindy J., Florida North past delegate, panel 58. Cindy? We are open with all ears, and if you do go on and on like we talked about, I'll let you know. I'll flash you a sign close to time. So without further ado, Cindy J.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Virginia Assembly, for letting me be here with you. I'm a little discombobulated, and I think a lot of us are when we start to speak. So I'm just going to take a second with some higher power. Okay. And my name is Cindy Jacobs, and I live in Tallahassee, Florida. I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. I came into this program in 1983 as one of the young people that we're trying so hard to get in now. And I was very, very fortunate for that. I had a kind of a crush on a guy who finally asked me out on a date. And on the second date, he said he had something to tell me, told me that he was an alcoholic, which I thought was very romantic because I didn't know anything about alcoholism. And I thought I could definitely help him. So you see, there was a program for me even before I knew it. And about a month after we started dating, he invited me to go to this booster club that met at the clubhouse. Booster Club for Wives is what he called it. And I just heard the word wife, and it was Al-Anon. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in October of 1983. And I went to this meeting, a small meeting, seven people, very old. I'm sure all of them were over 50. And they were kind. They talked in ways that I hadn't ever heard in my life, very friendly, honest, open, with humor. And then they invited me to come back, and they just kept saying that, keep coming back. So I thought I could probably help them too. And so I did keep going back. And my Al-Anon career, I look at it now, or career, my Al-Anon journey has been it's been nothing but a spiritual journey, even in the times that I didn't recognize it as a spiritual journey. I spent the first 10 years in Al-Anon, having a family, going to meetings with my husband. We would go to Al-Anon and AA meetings that met at the same time. And all our friends were in AA and Al-Anon, and that was a beautiful time for me to learn about the family disease. And I realized that I came from a long line of alcoholics in my family. My grandparents were alcoholics, all four of them. And so I grew up in a family of adult children trying to be grown-ups and trying to raise five kids with no tools. And so many of the things that I heard in the Al-Anon meetings were so familiar, but I couldn't understand why until I got a sponsor and got to understand what the family disease meant. And then 10 years in, my husband decided he wasn't an alcoholic anymore and began drinking. And that was 9 years of living with active alcoholism for the first time. And to this day, I can still pretty much say, I think living with active alcoholism is about the hardest thing I've ever had to do. Just the day in, day out of the despair and sadness and fear and loss of hope and loss of humor, loss of self. And I had 10 years in Al-Anon when that happened. And I can tell you that I didn't lose my belief in Al-Anon. I didn't lose my trust in Al-Anon. But what I lost was my human ability to stay 24/7 in Al-Anon. I went to meetings. I had my sponsor. I worked the steps in an entirely different way than I had before. But I also shrank my world into nothing. I hid the alcoholism as much as I could from everybody. I pretended to myself and others that I could be father and mother to my kids. I mean, the disease is insidious, cruel, and brutal. And so 9 years after that, we had one of those family experiences that I'm sure many people have. It was a very, very painful Christmas with a lot of drinking, a lot of horrible accusations. My children were young and they felt it as being a very violent day. I wasn't afraid of my husband. He was never a violent person, even though he was threatening all kinds of things. But I did get to the point where I said, we're going to a hotel. And that was the first time that I had sort of like, okay, there's a boundary and I'm done. So he got sober that day, which was December 26, 2000. And he, thankfully for him and for all of us, he's still sober, but that's his story. And for me, in a way, his second sobriety was a whole new opening into Al-Anon for me, because I could not hide any longer how angry I was that about those years of drinking. And my anger is something that I didn't have a lot of relationship with, because in my home when I was growing up, it was a pretty violent home, a lot of abuse and beating and hitting and that kind of stuff. So I avoided anger and thought that I could never be angry, and would have told you, I never get angry. My feelings hurt, but I don't get angry. Well, I couldn't avoid the fact that I was so angry that I left him then. I mean, he got sober, he was going back to AA, things were going to be really great. And I was like, there's no way I'm staying married to you. I'm out of here. I hate you. I hate everything. So I began a kind of craziness that went on for a couple of years. We ended up getting divorced and we're remarried now, because I'll forget to tell you that. And I've done that before. I go on and on. What happened too was that as we were working through our relationship as a couple of grown-ups who had hit the skids and hit a difficult time, our children, we had 3 girls in 3 years. And so they were now like 15, 15, and 16. And they began to drink and use drugs in a way that was alcoholic. And one by one, our daughters found their way into AA, all of them before they were 21. And it was during that time that we began to see how the disease affects our family. And we were in family therapy with one of the girls who was in rehab, and we began to realize, I mean, we were divorced at the time, but we were sitting at a speakerphone, and the child who was in rehab and their counselor, and we looked at each other and we realized we were talking about the traditions. We were talking about unity. We were talking about common welfare. We were talking about keeping our opinions to ourselves. We were talking about who's the authority in the family and having a higher power at the center of the family. And that led us to really change the way we were dealing with ourselves and each other. And that's when we ended up working our way back to getting married, and then together dealing with the family disease as it went on to another generation. So that's my like Al-Anon, excuse me, that's my what happened, how what it was like. There's a lot of other details, but for me, it was a long time ago. For me, the important piece about my Al-Anon life is the spirituality of today, of what happened as I have remained faithful to these 12 steps, and especially the third step. I consider myself part of the third step tribe or third step congregation or whatever. That's the third step people. So I like to share a series of spiritual awakenings that I've had in a kind of chronological way through this basic sort of time period that is very common, you know, to live with sobriety, live with relapse, live with the children drinking. And so here are some of the major spiritual awakenings that I've experienced that to me keep me coming back on a regular, very regular basis. So when our middle daughter was 16 and she was in rehab, she came home for a visit right before she was going to be let out. And while she was here, she was standing in our carport with an unknown to me. I didn't know this guy. She was 17. I don't know who he was. She was telling me one of those stories that you hear with alcoholics, that one of those long, drawn out, very detailed stories that you know is absolutely not true, but it just keeps getting more and more detailed and more. And she looked at me and she put her hands on her hips and she says, "You don't trust me." And I heard myself say, "I don't have to trust you, Anna. I love you. I trust God and I love you. So do what you need to do." And we were both very surprised by that. And so she kind of went on. I went inside and sat down in a chair and said, "What was that? What is that? Is it even possible that that's true?" I do an 11th step process that several times a day, I sit down for 5 minutes of silence and just sit in that. So I began to, during that 11th step practice every day, just say, "Is it possible that I can trust God and just love my family member?" And it turns out to be true. And it turns out to be one of the biggest changes of my whole life, a fundamental change and shift in the direction of my life, that I no longer deal with human beings, and it's gone way past just my family, about trying to get them to act in a trustworthy way so I can trust them. I don't have to trust anybody. I can trust God, and I can do my best to love my fellow human being. And that has changed my life, and it has changed my relationships, and especially with, as my daughters got older and now they're all in their 30s, and our relationships, it's not about them telling me the truth or being trustworthy. It's about my focus staying on that trusting of my higher power, whatever is happening. And that led to the next one, which was about a year or so later, when our older daughter called me in the spring, and I wish I could tell you the years, but I can't remember the years. But she called in the spring, and she was in college, and she said, "Oh, hey, Mom, I got a white chip. I went to a meeting last night. I went to the meeting tonight, and I got a white chip." And we all knew what that meant in our family, because in this particular part of the country, a white chip is what a newcomer to AA picks up, a white chip, meaning I'm going to try not to drink. My intention is not to have a drink in 24 hours. So I was so excited. I was sitting in my car. I was just driving home. So I was sitting in my car in my carport, just on the cell phone with her. And she told me a funny story. And then she said, "Oh, and by the way, did I tell you that I've been on crack?" And I did not know that. And I said, "No, you have not told me that." And I felt my whole world sort of lurch in that moment into a place that I don't know about this. This is not the same thing as getting a white chip. And she said, "Well, I'm gonna try not to do that tonight too." And I can remember hearing myself say, and I'm in my car, "Good luck with that." I did not start driving to Sarasota, which is a 8-hour drive, to save her. I remember just saying good luck. And I I sort of stumbled out of my car at that point into our yard. We live out in the country. And I fell onto the ground sobbing. And I felt it was twilight, the dark was coming, there were mosquitoes, I was sobbing, snot, mud, mosquitoes. I thought I might even have a psychotic break. I could not see any lightness from here. And it actually happened to be Good Friday, if you celebrate any kind of Christian religion. And I kept hearing, God is dead, God is dead. Yes, this is what this feels like. This is true. God is dead. That kept sort of reverberating in my mind until I felt huge presence coming up from the ground that I was laying on, holding me. I felt this huge, solid presence and this awareness come into my whole being that basically said, I am bigger than this. Began to sense that God is bigger than this, whatever this is. And I began to feel held by the earth, by God, by whatever. It's too hard to create words for it, except it was so real and so tangible. And I knew that there's nothing I could do about my daughter and crack. Or alcohol or anything else. But I knew that whatever happened in my life, this power is bigger than that. And I could be in that power, in that power. And for some reason, some way, I was able to get up, wash my face, go to bed, and I went to sleep. And the next morning, my sister, who lived in the same town, called and said, Molly wants to go to rehab. Can I take her? Will you pay? And we were like, yeah. But, and that's her story. But I have always felt that it's because I didn't get in the car to go save her. I didn't get in between her and her higher power. And my higher power was big enough to reach that far away and do what needed to be done. And my job was to trust that higher power. And stay. So it really became another part of that spiritual awakening that I can trust this higher power. I can really turn my life and will over. I can, you know, without becauses and without buts and without ifs. And I'm not super religious about church or anything else because I do get a little distracted by people. And so whenever in my spiritual life, I bump into somebody else's spiritual beliefs that are not mine, I just practice Al-Anon where I say, yeah, take what I like and leave the rest. And I, you know, that's awesome for you, totally not for me. And so it doesn't lend itself for me joining many church type things, but I love them and appreciate them for people. My husband is actually very involved in the church around the corner from our house, and it's wonderful. But for me, there's something so visceral and tangible about this higher power and my presence in this world, in this planet. Currently, my image of my higher power is a galaxy photo. We have those most beautiful photographs that are coming back from cameras all over the galaxy, and I see a galaxy of these stars in an order, and I say, I see myself as a part, a tiny part of this huge order. And when I can put myself in that perspective, then the things that I need or want, or they're all fine, but they're all part of an order. And I take great comfort from being in that order. So these are really big things. And so this higher power also comes to me in small ways. My youngest daughter, so they're just 1 year apart, all these girls. And so my youngest daughter, watching her sisters and everything, she went to college and she drank about everything she could get her hands on for one semester, had a bad reaction in January, woke up and said, I'm going to go to AA. And she called a person from AA and went to an AA meeting and has been sober ever since. And that's kind of how she lives her life, you know, very methodical and very thoughtful and everything. But I've also always thought of her as being my sort of Al-Anon gift, because she always has asked me for my advice and she took it. So it was like the perfect combo for somebody. For me, I felt like that was my reward for going to Al-Anon all these times. God was going to give me this person who would ask for my advice. So I wasn't giving unsolicited advice. And when I said, I think that she would do it. And she lived in the same town, and we are quite close, but I began in those 11th steps. This is the 11th step, so powerful in my life. So in these 5 minutes, five or six times a day, began to get pictures of her in my head. And I was wondering why, because she's not a problem. So what in the world could be? And I kept at it until what I understood was that I don't need to give her my advice even when she asks for it. That was such a foreign concept to me. I mean, but I kept getting this sense that she is not mine. She is not, if she's asking my advice, my best response is going to be, I don't know, but I know you can do it, or here's my experience, or whatever. It also changed me in a way that was smaller and maybe more nuanced, but more heartfelt. And certainly it changed my spiritual life, because, again, back to my childhood, one of the safety coping mechanisms that I picked up as a child was, if you're right, you have authority. If you're right about something, then that gives you an authority. So I always wanted to be right. And then I felt like I could enforce or control or manipulate to get what I wanted because I'm right. I wasn't saying, hey, everybody, let's go rob a bank and I'm going to make you do that. I would never do that. But I would say, hey, we're all going to clean up the room, or we're all going to go on a diet or whatever. I'm right. This process with my youngest daughter was about, again, step three, you know, turning my will and my life over to the care of my higher power, not my idea of what is right, or what I think everybody should do, or what even possibly is the most efficient way to run a meeting. I got into service when my daughters were drinking and in their teen years. And I know that sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but it certainly felt counterintuitive, because I'm super busy with all these drinking alcoholic teenagers that are doing things like pawning everything in the house and smashing up cars all over town and selling drugs at school. But going into service was really important for me. But one of the reasons I went into service was because I didn't like the way they were doing it up there. You know, that's not the way you do the treasurer. So boom, I'm going to stand for treasurer. And I don't even balance my own checking account. And my husband was like, what? But I'm like, I don't know, that I can figure out. But being treasurer was a spiritual experience of handling the energy, the checks, the energy that was coming from every little group supporting Al-Anon. And I learned how to balance that checkbook, and I learned how to do it, and I loved it. And it helped me not be focusing on getting everybody sober and keeping them track about what everybody was doing. And so this 11th step process and my service work, as I was changing my relationship with this precious daughter, it changed my relationship with my service work. Because I know I can even admit all the way, I spent a lot of time telling people what to do and didn't always wait for them to ask me, but I spent a lot of time with this is the right thing, this is what we need to do, and this is what we're going to do. And so carefully, thoughtfully, and with a lot of love, Al-Anon members in Florida North kept inviting me to come back, try again, and be of service and keep learning, and that happened for me. And I was able to be the treasurer in our area. I was able to be the chairperson in our area. And then in panel 58, I was the delegate, which was beyond my wildest dreams to be able to serve at that, in that position. And during the time that I was delegate, I understood the spiritual principles of our program at work in ways that I am privileged to be able to now carry into my life. And one of them, I would say that the biggest spiritual awakening I got or from that time, and it's still evolving because it was just, you know, it was just last year, but is this spiritual principle that we depend on so much called mutual respect. So for me, mutual respect is, you know, I treat you well and you treat me well. When I came into the idea of mutual respect before I was the delegate, before I had the opportunities that I did, I think I had twisted that in my mind, which was, I will treat you this way so that you will treat me this way. And that was pretty manipulative on my part, because I figured if I was nice to you, then you will be nice to me. If I am honest with you, then you will be honest with me. Like, that was the exchange rate. And I began to see that that's my alcoholic family in action. And so I watched at my first conference and second and third conference, I watched people treating me with respect because that's what they do. They treat me with respect. And so I wasn't actually manipulating them into it. I would treat them with respect and they would treat me with respect. And so I felt and experienced mutual respect. That was so different from relationships, even with my husband or my kids, because it took out that I have to do this so you'll do that. That's always sort of driving me underneath. But the funny thing is, my third conference, and we had to go virtual in the pandemic, and there was just like so much different stuff, so many fears and so many things. Mutual respect came to be the thing I could do regardless of what the other person did. I can practice mutual respect because we are in a situation together. We are in some relationship. We are on a meeting, and Terry and I certainly experienced this a lot as we worked with we had a wonderful task force, but we had to work with all kinds of other things that were out of our control, things that we were told to do, things that we were told not to do, things that we were told to do and then told not to do, and, you know, just all kinds of things like that. And some of that doesn't feel respectful. Some of that, like for me anyway, I mean, I'm still Cindy, so I could still say, hey, it would have been better if you had told me this way. That's one of my favorites. You know, if you would just ask me first before you talk to me, I can tell you the right way to say it. The thing that helps me let go of that is mutual respect. Like, I don't need respect from somebody else for me to now be. I can do that. I can presume goodwill. I can still be angry. I can still be frustrated. I can still be hurt. During this pandemic year, I've had an incredible experience. I know my higher power just loves me so much because all my tests are so gentle. But it was just my husband and myself in the house, and I was going to try to experiment with feeling my feelings, you know, like feeling my feelings. I could say that. I have a God box. I have all kinds of things, you know, but I'm like, I need to do something a little different here. So I set a timer and sat in my chair in the living room, and I just was angry. I was really ticked off at somebody. I just like humped and grumped and my husband walked by and he said, "What's the matter? Don't talk to me. Don't talk. I'm feeling my feelings." and the timer rang, and then I got out. But what I found was, like, I survived. It wasn't a big deal. It was just a feeling. And since that time, that was like last April or May. So for this year, my feeling my feelings doesn't take that long anymore. I don't even have to set a timer, but I can sit in that chair and I can be so angry, or I can be so sad or so jealous. My husband does a thing every other Tuesday that I don't want him to do. And I've told him in many, many ways, I don't like it when you do that. It makes me feel bad when you do that. I really wish you wouldn't do that. Why do you have to do that? And he said, I understand, but I'm going to do that. And I thought, well, I have to be angry. So every other Tuesday, I'd be angry. Every other Tuesday, I'd be, oh, I'm have my feelings hurt. Oh, I'm such a victim. Oh, and then I realized that I don't have to do any of those things. I can, and every other Tuesday, sometimes I might. But I don't have to. I don't have to. I have a choice about that. And I think that the mutual respect part, where I can get out of trying to bargain my way into getting what I want, allows me that freedom and kind of a power of the right sort, the power to make a choice. I have had a difficult relationship with my family. And when my older brother, who I was not close with at all, got very, very ill, I spent a lot of time with my brother and my parents, walking them through that. And they don't, any of them have recovery. And so as he was dying, the family discussion centered around when he's going to get better and God's going to cure him. And he's getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And when he died, the day he died, I was at his house. It was the morning and about this time. And his wife and kids and my parents, everybody was milling about because I don't know why. It's not because. They were milling about. That's all I'm saying. But he was laying in this bed. So I went over to the bed and I held his hand and he couldn't speak. And we were looking at each other. And he seemed to me to be so scared. And so I just held his gaze. And you know that higher power from the earth? That higher power just came up through me. And I felt that move through me into my brother. I just felt that energy move into him. And I watched him relax. I watched him let go and die. And he was peaceful. He felt that and he was held. And I had that opportunity with another human being. Not even, we weren't that close, but we were that close because my higher power can give me those opportunities to be present, to be open, to put my judgments aside and to just be of service. Like in that moment, I was able to be of service to my higher power. And I think of that a lot. And at first I thought about it like, oh, it's too bad that it wasn't Carol or my mom or somebody, you know, that really, really like knew how much they loved him and everything, that they could have experienced that. But for whatever reason, it was just the way God did it. And I just can let go of all my judgments and, you know, and I feel honored and I feel a sacred connection and I feel grateful and humble to my recovery that allows me to be in situations and just be present. So I'm going to tell you what happened to me on Thursday, this Thursday. My husband and I are at home. It's just the two of us. Told you we live a little bit out in the country. And we went to bed about 9 o'clock and watched a TV show and turned the lights out. And he turned one way to read his Kindle and I turned the other way and turned on a meditation to listen to go to sleep. And the next thing I knew, there was a flashlight and a gun in my face. And a man saying, "Don't move." And I'm pretty sure I screamed, and then I didn't move. And And over the next 15 minutes, he zip-tied my hands and feet. He zip-tied Joe's hands. He yanked my wedding and engagement rings off my fingers as my hands were tied like this. He knocked over some things looking for stuff in the nightstands. He asked for valuables and cash, and he made my husband get up out of the bed and walked him into the kitchen with a gun in his back to get cash to give to him. Then he brought him back into the bedroom, put him back in the bed, zip tied his feet, ransacked some more of the house, and then came back into our room and dropped something on the bed and left. And it was a pair of scissors. And there are a couple things I want to tell you about that. Like, when he was zip tying my hands, I could still hear my meditation playing. And I heard this voice saying, "Let the cares of the day slip away. Everything will be all right." And I just connected those two things. I mean, I'm not going to tell you I was calm, because I wasn't calm, but I was kind of catatonic shock. But I remember that coming into my ear. I think of that as my higher power. My husband's voice was calm and cooperative, and he did everything right. And I feel like he protected me. My husband has congestive heart failure, COPD, rheumatoid arthritis. He can barely walk, but he protected me. How's that? So anyway, so we're laying there in the dark and we realize it's a pair of scissors, and his hands are like this because he has rheumatoid arthritis, but he got the scissors up and I slid my hands over the scissors, and we laughed because he can barely use scissors. But he did. He was able to cut me off, and I cut us. We got up, we called 911. The sheriffs were there. They were so wonderful. Everybody has been wonderful. Our three daughters flew from all over the country and came in, and they're here with us now this weekend. And they, of course, have installed cameras everywhere, and locks are changed. And they're... That's the most afraid I've ever been in my life. It was one of my biggest fears ever coming true. And it was scary, and I'm not telling you it's not scary. It's like alcoholism. It's freaking scary to be in alcoholism. But there is a power greater than me. I knew I was gonna die. This is my human. My human me knew I was gonna die in that bed with that gun pointed at me. Never had a gun pointed at me. I knew I was gonna die. My higher power, I don't know, had a different plan. And all I had to do was just be present. I didn't have to be clever. I didn't have to be smart. I didn't have to think about, can I get my phone? Can I go? I didn't do anything. I just stayed with it. We both were praying. We later talked about how much praying we were doing quietly as this was all happening. This morning, we open our days every day with prayer and meditation together with coffee at 6 o'clock in the morning. I've been doing this all during the pandemic. So this morning, it was sounds cheesy, but whatever, I'm just gonna say it, but it just felt so natural to pray for that guy. You know, I hope they catch him. I hope that never happens to anybody else ever in the whole world. But he's still a human being. And I don't have to trust human beings. And I don't have to make people act a certain way. I have a power greater than me who is always with me, who will always be present for me. And all I have to do is show up to that higher power, ask, listen, do the next right thing. And I learned that in Al-Anon. I learned that in Al-Anon. And I practiced it in Al-Anon. And when the thing in my life happened that I thought would be the worst thing that could ever happen, and I hope maybe it is, I was able to do what I practiced in Elmont. I was able to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I'm so grateful for that. And I am pretty scatterbrained right now, and I barely know my name, and it's probably a good idea for me not to drive very much or go anyplace, but I was also so grateful to know that I could come to this meeting this morning and be with Al-Anon members and be with people who love me, even though I only know one of you, but I know that you love me. I know that this thing we're doing is real, and it makes a difference in our lives, and it makes a difference in the lives of others. So I really appreciate everybody who is doing service in Virginia and keeping this program going, because it saves lives. Thank you. Thank you for letting me be here.